Met a ghost of a king on the road when I first fell. Fire burning to my knees, I fell. Met a ghost of a king on the road.
I hear that we are on course for another airplane story.
Are we?
Oh, I don't know.
You know, post-vacation, there's not a lot to talk about, except apparently all the movies dropped that I guess we watch on an airplane.
We have basically this could be like a movie mop-up because we've referred to a number of them. Cabrini's in theaters, Boys in the Boats, now available on the home video, as they say.
I've been shouting Dune, everything I can remember from Dune. From Denis Villeneuve all over.
Yeah. Dune. The Maker series is coming here.
Yep. To Canon soon. Plus.
Canon Plus.
I'm sure you saw that with Doug Tennapel.
Yep. And then, we got like movie mop up. And then I was off tromping around Mayan ruins a little bit.
Wow.
And sprinting through SeaTac. I think that's.
SeaTac, Mayan ruins are for leisure. SeaTac is for the
sprint. SeaTac was for getting home, the getting home phase. And just another reminder that the wheels are coming off literally everywhere.
Yeah.
In our economy. Sometimes they're coming off of airplanes as they take off.
Yeah.
And bouncing through parking lots. And sometimes they're just coming off metaphorically.
Right.
Which is what I was dealing with. And it's just everywhere. Like pieces are literally falling off of airplanes. As my son said, if you can imagine a sign of social decay, just conjure one up in your head. It's probably already happened.
Yeah. A wheel falling off a plane.
Doors falling off of planes. Yeah. Wheels falling off of planes. United Airlines having to send out a CEO note about how their planes are falling apart in midair. But, you know, bear with us. Pardon our dust.
There's so many videos. Pardon our dust. People just looking out the window and seeing missing bolts or things leaking out of the plane.
It's just wild right now. And of course, that's how it's working politically for us. It's working that way in terms of entertainment. It's working that way all over the place. People are just in the shakedown. Like we're all in the composter right now. We are definitely here with the red worms and the raw eggs, and we're composting hardcore.
Right. You need those tiger worms, though. It's not just the regular earthworms that can do the composting.
Yes.
I remember reading an article on that as a kid and being like, I got to get some of those worms.
Got to get me some of them worms for sure.
Bucket list creature. I don't know if you've seen one, but the Palouse giant earthworm. Have you seen any of those?
Yeah.
You found one?
No, I've not seen them like in my backyard. Seen them?
Right. Okay.
I've not found them. I just hear the tremors as they pass underneath me.
Wow.
Dune style.
Yeah. A 2 or 3 foot earthworm would be almost as cool to me as Shai Hulud.
Yeah. They're big. Those are the babies, the 2 to 3 footers, the 34 footers are the real, the real blue giant earthworms.
See, and they have
in the mythologies of what I just made up.
They have a smell of lilac, I believe, is what I've heard.
They smell like lilac?
That's what I heard.
That explains my allergies.
But anyways, they all think we're
joking. There's a story about a small boy who everywhere he walked, he was followed by a pack of giant Palouse earthworms, but never knew because they were all just under every footstep.
Yeah.
Rippling.
Right. And it's not sand, so you can't, you can't see the track.
Really grappling hook them.
Right.
And ride.
They're also not that predatory, so.
That we know. Either that or they're very effective. Extremely efficient.
Right. Anyways, we're joking about some of that, but not all of it, and you have to figure out what is true.
Some of that was AI generated.
But yeah, no.
I asked AI and said, just guess, just predict, what would we have in the Palouse? And they said, a giant earthworm. Mm. All the robots came up with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are we covering today, Brian? Actually,
I think we're back from vacation.
Did I just vacation?
No, we did a very quick vacation up to Coeur d'Alene. Spent basically 12 hours in a pool with all of my children and
12 hours in a pool.
Yeah.
A novel.
Right. When you get the 10 and 8-year-old boys to like actually get out of the pool, when you say, hey, get out of the pool, because they're so tired, that's when you know you've achieved vacation success. They're not like, oh, dad, let's do one more game. They're just like rats. slowly slinking out of the back to the hotel room.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So my vacation consisted of a lot of amazing food, sleep, and work, getting work done.
Interesting.
Which is funny. That's kind of a vacation now.
Yeah. No soul food. That's the vacation. That's what it really was.
Yeah, well, a little vacation from the podcast.
What's the takeaway from the Mayan ruins, though? Did you feel like you wrote, you didn't write Mayan ruins into Outlaws. You had Aztec.
There's so much in the Western Hemisphere that's just insane. So.
Yeah.
Fully insane. And to kind of flashback and look at, just like try to glimpse Europe and glimpse the new world. It's, you know, kind of ridiculous that the bigger, more effective empires were in the new world.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the Inca is incredible.
Because you're thinking post-Roman Empire.
Yeah.
We jump over to the big ones that lasted.
Yeah, there's all the
centuries. Yeah. Are Incans, Mayans.
So we don't, you don't really get into post-Christendom, right? And by Christendom, I mean the Holy Roman Empire. You know, it's like sort of the what Constantine ushered in and what we dealt with, you know, in all the aftermath post that. You don't really see the modern imperial states coming into existence until the Reformation and the fracturing of loyalty to Rome. And so you see England and France and Spain and, you know, everybody's doing their thing. Meanwhile, there's in the Far East, there are these incredible dynasties. But in the West, if you're starting in Europe, to their east and to their west were incredible, massive dynastic operations. And it's truly incredible. I mean, where we were was Maya. But yeah, the Aztec were a thing, obviously. But they were kind of a short-lived thing.
As you'd assume from something so violent.
But that's the weird part. We know about how bloody and violent the Aztecs were, but the Maya were no cupcakes. You know, it's...
Unfortunately, I only know about them from Age of Empires. So that's the sad part of it.
So when you go, like, we went to Chichen Itza, which is one of these really famous sites. And I'll say a couple of things here. One is you go out into the jungle, you go to the literal middle of nowhere. This is not on a strategic point. This is not a mountain. This is not a harbor. This is just where there, it was near three cenote, you know, underwater river cave systems. It was near the mouths of three cenotes. And the different tribes had their sacred cenotes, you know, their entry points. So they built there. It was conquered once, then they built a big Castillo, you know, in the middle. But you show up and you are looking at the largest ball court, you know, those hoop games, right, in, you know, in the Western Hemisphere, which is just, or I'm trying to think who might be bigger. It might just be in Central America. There might be one somewhere else, but a giant one. It's a really giant ball court. And you kind of walk around and you look at the altars where they would sacrifice the people. And and then you look at the complexity of the Central Pyramid and what it does, you know, as they're describing the shadow art it was designed to create on the solstices. So it actually does a Quetzalcoatl, like wriggling Quetzalcoatl in the solstices, or some, you know, feathered serpent thing.
Wow.
And that it even acoustically was designed to imitate the bird call of some sacred bird to the Maya. If you clap at its base, it breaks your clap. The echo is broken and it becomes this bird warble.
Does that still work?
Yeah. And it's like, okay, so we have acoustic design. We've got shadow design. We're doing the solstice obsessed stuff.
Yeah.
Just like you see solstice obsessed stuff anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
You see it in the Orkneys. You get all the way up to Maze Howe, one of the cooler places I've ever been. And it's designed for the solstices. And down here, in
Egypt,
in Mexico, it's designed for the solstices.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I was taking my kids around and I told them, I was like, imagine in 2350, some dad taking his kids on a tour of some death camp in Germany. Mm-hmm. And they have all the doodads and trinkets and skulls and everything all on plastic for you to buy at the death camps. You know, like that's kind of what we're dealing with here. This was a blood religion. Mm. And this is this big platform of skulls. There's this huge, and this is where it occurred to me. There's this massive platform of skulls. And it was built entirely to display the heads of victims. And it's pretty tall. It's not like a giant thing, but it's a, you know, it's my height. And it's got rows and rows, maybe a little taller, but rows all the way around it of bricks. Every single brick has been carved in the shape of a skull, has a relief of a skull on it, and in varying stages of decomposing all the way around it. So
out of
it's
brick.
It's severed head. Just it's a relief on the stone. So so they carved it in relief on the stone, and there's the severed head that's not quite, you know, it's just rotting over time. You can go around and the heads are all decomposing, and this is where they would platform these long poles that were just decorated like Christmas trees with heads, severed heads. And then the, you know, the human sacrificial altars, and you're like, oh, and this is the non-bloody, these are not the bloody people from this area.
Oh, right.
Like these are, this is the Maya. These are the peace-loving hippies of this whole, of this whole region.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. But then if you get to the Inca, their road system and their stonework and everything they did, building roads everywhere, is very Roman and incredible. And then they, I really don't know that the Spaniards would have successfully taken the Inca if they'd really hadn't had smallpox on their side.
Right.
Like, they couldn't handle the terrain. It was, there was so much strategic disadvantage. But the Mayan ruins, I'm sitting here telling my kids, it's like, this is like hundreds of years from now, people selling Nazi doodads, selling, you know, the little SS symbol and the, you know, the skull and everything else. Like, this was awful. This was just absolutely awful. Now, it's also incredible, super impressive,
right?
Amazing. This incredible city, just because they were near three cave entrances, and that's why this whole thing's here. But it's also just dead.
Yeah.
It's this exoskeleton. It's like finding a conch shell. Mm. You know, there's this exoskeleton of a civilization, of a people. And it made me wonder what we're going to leave, because we are absolutely 100% in that tiger worm phase. Like we're, I mean, look at our airlines, our flying machines, you know, like we've peaked.
Yeah.
We've done some amazing things.
Our managerial class has squeezed all of the dollars out, and all of a sudden we found out we lost the people who are making the things.
Yeah. So I had enough sleep and enough ceviche to have some nice contemplative times, but the ruins were really striking.
Yeah.
Just really, really striking.
Just a mortality reminder for
people. From an incredible civilization. Like just what they accomplished is insane. And what happened? And Tulum, just south of where we were, just north of where we were, actually, I think, somewhere just next
just
to where
close.
We were. Yeah. Somewhere just next to us. Tulum is this other site of ruins. And one of the things that was enjoyable about it, the most enjoyable about it, is it's these cliff sides, you know, buildings. They had some towers and stuff above a harbor. And apparently the Spaniards showed up here. This was their point of contact. With the mainland. They'd gone through the islands and dealt with some Caribs, you know, dealt with some of the tribes and more primitive civilizations. And then they floated up and saw this stone complex.
Yeah, huge.
On the cliff and thought, and they sailed away.
Yeah.
It was just like, wait, this is something else. This is
much bigger.
Yeah, this is much bigger. And luckily we've brought our diseases with us.
Yeah.
So
hand out the blankets.
Yeah. The ruins are incredible and they're amazing, but it's also, it made me think a lot about politics and the U.S. and decay, because driving, I had to go to Seattle to get my passport, and it was a whole thing before we left, and driving back through the mountains, it's kind of amazing that we see it. We're surrounded by mountains here. There's a lot of mountains, but mountains are always falling down. They're crumbling. They have landslides. And conservatives are like the people who are all fighting to save the mountain. Like they're all just tending the mountain as it just decays, as it washes away, as it sends down its avalanches and rubble. But nobody really thinks about the inevitable times when mountains have to be made. Mm. Like there are these punctuated moments in time when mountains get heaped up, when the volcanoes go, you know, when the earthquakes really slam.
Yeah.
Those are your World War II phases. Those are your big cataclysmic geopolitical earthquakes and so on. And then after the fact, conservatives just don't want the mountain to decay any more than it already has.
Yeah.
They have no strategy for rebuilding a mountain. You know, you can't collect all the gravel and put it back on. You know, it's like, it's just not going to work. But I really do think that we're kind of overdue
for some mountain building.
I think we're overdue for some significant shakeups. Mm. And that's part of what I've said about composting, you know, culture's compost, and then there's explosive growth.
Yeah.
Out of the compost. But looking around at the Maya, you know.
Yeah, empire. And
looking at these empires, looking at these things, and there's these outside the system shockwaves that just, you know.
Took them out.
Yeah, just overthrow it. But similar things happened, like when Luther, you know, what ended quote unquote Christendom? A centralized power, you know, through Western Europe.
The printing press.
And a dude with a piece of paper.
Yeah, a mountain.
Like just one thing. And then all the shakeup starts, the big tumult starts. And the Reformed princes and the Reformation and the Anglican Church and all this stuff starts shaking. Where before it's like Eastern, Western, you know, the Orthodox, the Catholics.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Well, this story of shakeup and how individuals find their lives blended into a bigger purpose does sound like Dune.
Yeah, a little bit. And Masters of the Air, right. You know, if we're going to tie another content, Bomber Group show on Apple, on VidAngel, by the way, worth filtering. But think about what was going on in Europe and how just psycho World War II was.
Yeah, what a crazy time.
And then it left us with a new status quo, which we decided was a status quo, like really quick. This is the status quo.
Yeah.
And then now, you know, all the grinding of the gears still post that. And Dune is, I think, very successfully captures the big grinding glacial movements that create real shakeup.
Right. Well, I was curious what you thought about, obviously we've talked a lot about how prophecy becomes, like how Tamar and others were active. We think they're actively tracking prophecies throughout time.
Yep.
In a way that Frank Herbert is clearly trying to overtly say, I think prophecies are both created and somehow not. I guess I was curious what your
created
thought is.
Created
and lived. Yeah. But very much, you know, Paul becoming what he was sort of is both his action of choosing to become it, and then also the fact of where he's put in history, and then also the belief of this, you know, tribesman. I was curious what do you think's going on there? It felt like I think the energy of Dune is very Old Testament in a way that is surprising to people and enjoyable, and perhaps feels of one piece of fabric.
There's so many things there that people knee-jerk. People talk about the Islamic influences,
yeah,
you know, in the film, and they're kind of absent, you know, apart from costumery.
Yep.
You know, that
Lisan al-Gaib sounds kind of Muslim.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like there's decor.
Right.
There's some decor here, but then they have a lot of weird tech.
Yeah.
And it's an egalitarian society.
Yeah.
And so that's not what we're...
That's not the people of... I was reading...
And poor little Zendaya is so sad because she wants an egalitarian relationship. And she likes Paul because he's... This is... And I can just pop off here and say that there's something really funny in Zendaya's character, but that she likes him because he's the one. She can be in a relationship with him because he doesn't believe that he's the one. She likes him because he actually has all the character traits and the strength and the abilities that are required to be the one, as long as he doesn't believe that he is, because then he's just into himself. He's just being into himself, and she's mad.
Her
and
character was so bad.
Was it though? People have complained about it. Let me just say, bad to what end?
I think that she didn't fit in that story.
That chick who just is ticked off about him like stepping up.
Well, what to me it felt like is just airdropping a modern girl into this story that felt like it needed, you know, concubines are nothing new in the Dune world. And in the actual story, I think she has a kid with Paul.
No, she'll get invited to the harem for sure.
Right. But that sort of, I suppose letting her be frustrated about that. But Paul's mom is a concubine of Leto. Like that whole situation to me just didn't make sense, that she was so naive about power structure and how power works. And then also I didn't like that she did it with a kind of like pouty face for the whole 2 hours of the movie.
Let's just go ahead and say she could have been more interesting. But the fact is, I think their dynamic is underexploited. And okay. Her self-contradictory dynamic is very real.
Okay.
And it is a very real thing. People resent, are attracted to and resent things all the time.
Yeah.
And so she wants this egalitarian relationship. She wants this relationship with this dude who does not believe in himself and never steps up. Because if he steps up, he's going to rule. And the Fremen will no longer be this egalitarian people. They'll have this, this one. There will be a ruler in a new and complete way. She is a conservative in that she's trying to preserve the mountain. And the mountain is the Fremen people. The mountain is the way it has been.
Yeah.
Trying to preserve the way it has been. And then, of course, you have these other characters where you are really excited. They're pumped to see a new mountain.
Yeah, Stilgar. I would follow Stilgar into battle. Yeah. That guy was exactly awesome.
He's great. And he's so thrilled and excited to see all the old ways.
Yeah.
Get thrown off and a new mountain rise. And this is, incidentally, this is what the Pharisees struggled with. This is what all sorts of people, this is what Denethor struggles with, you know, where you have somebody who's tending the promise.
Yeah.
And then it becomes about the unfulfilled promise as opposed to
the fulfillment.
The fulfillment. So if you have been gardening with your ancestors generationally, one direction, and then it's all you're saying someday this giant king will erupt out of this garden and the whole garden will be just gone.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be obliterated. Then suddenly that happens. There's a ton of resentment of the destruction of the status quo, the destruction of the way it was. So even though her people were oppressed, they were themselves.
Yeah.
It was a certain way.
Okay.
And despite that, it was a certain way. So the dude shows up. She's attracted to him for all the reasons that start to cause Stilgar to believe he's the one. She's attracted to him for those same reasons, but she can only be in the relationship with him as long as he's full of self-doubt, as long as he doesn't believe the prophecies, as long as he's not going to rise up, as long as he's going to be your equal, as long as he can become Fremen, as long as the Fremen don't change. Mm. And instead, he's going to be this eruption of an entirely new power structure that's going to overhaul her people.
It seemed much flatter to me than that. You're making it sound too good, Nate.
No, it is her. There's
like, I didn't like her snarky group of girlfriends kind of laughing at the prophecy versus these sort of Stilgar making fun of him or the movie making fun of
Stilgar. So this is an example where as a storyteller, I would see people circling things saying delete and I'd be saying expand.
Okay.
It needs more.
Okay.
So the Northern girls snarking and not believing versus the Southern fundamentalists.
Yeah.
The thing I hated about that was the word fundamentalist.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
That was so anachronistic and it didn't make any sense to me.
Right.
They needed to call it something.
They're
else.
They're all fundamentalists.
But having a regional divide.
Yeah.
Was really interesting that they're true believers.
Okay.
And then up here, we're all kind of, we've been in the blast radius of the empire. And so we're all more jaded and secular.
Mm.
That's interesting. And that's very real. You know, that's the kind of thing that happens. But it's so flippantly and shallowly touched on.
Gotcha.
And then with her, I thought, for example, there's an opportunity where to have Paul make a choice when he goes to drink the poison. you could have Paul make an actual decision contra his, you know, his girlfriend, where she's saying, don't do it. Because for him to do that is to take a step in faith that he's actually
the one. Yeah.
The one. Otherwise, he's going to die. And for him to know her name, have known her real name, and to know the prophecy and know that that will put a burden on her to bring him back. It'll be up to her to bring him back or let him stay dead. Mm-hmm. And to push his chips in on that could have been very, very interesting.
Okay.
And force her hand.
They kind of unzipped the two of the narratives. And so it became
accidental. And it becomes a little Deus Ex Machina where it's just like, oh, phew. Good thing she coincidentally happened to be here and coincidentally happened to be named this and she couldn't cry right now.
Right.
You know, it's like,
okay,
it's,
I see.
That if he had actually done that and that's him stepping away from her and also forcing her to assist him in that, which would be something she would not forgive and would not want, as opposed to now, it's just like, wait, he came back. Why is she mad?
Yeah.
You know, and so I think there's all these little, there are these unexploited things, but as a character, it's a complex thing that people have. Yeah. It's really complicated.
Well, I guess maybe this is what you're touching on, but you remember when one of the northern girl Fremen gets flamethrowed by the guy in the cave, you know, it's supposed to be. Yeah. And we don't really care a whole lot, but we would have cared if it had been Stilgar perhaps, or one of the other guys. Yeah. I don't know. That moment to me felt kind of encapsulated everything that I was wishing was more.
Yeah.
Because I did enjoy it, obviously, but I remember watching that and being like, oh, I'm supposed to care, but she and her, what she's standing for, just seems really annoying in this and underdeveloped and a bit fake.
So I think there's lots of mood and atmosphere, and it's very mood and atmosphere heavy.
Yeah.
It could have done with more dilemmas, with more horns, like clear.
Okay.
Like, you know, clear horns of a dilemma situations for characters. So Zendaya's character has taken a beating critically. Yeah. You know, people complain about it. And I actually think that most people are missing.
Okay. So it's not that she's unrealistic or could have been unrealistic. It's that they didn't do enough of it. It's the expand thing.
And that's the kind of mistake that could have just happened in the editing room. Like that's actually, that could be an editorial mistake. That could be an editorial decision in post-production where certain lines and moments are thrown on the cutting room floor and
they give her depth and
give her and they little think bit more. They're sort of like, man, okay, we have enough here. It lands. It doesn't. We have one reference to the meaning of her name and then she choppers in real fast.
Yeah. And there's a moment of tension as we're like, uh-oh, is he going to die? Well, clearly not.
Yeah. And so, but that tells me that there's a thread that split them and he made a choice and there's a scene missing between the two of them when he forces her hand by taking a step towards the fulfillment of the prophecy that she hates and doesn't believe in. And hilariously reveals that she hates it more than she doesn't believe in it. He does every single thing. He clearly is the one. He's clearly the fulfillment of it and still ticks her off.
Right.
It's not about unbelief. It's about resenting the shattering of the old way and the replacement of it with a new mountain.
And didn't they kind of make it cheaper by making it about the other princess at the end? Like, you think that fits for Chani?
I think that works. It just also, I would love for there to be just another beat with her. Not him walking over to her in a crowd saying, I'll always love you. And I'm going to propose to her now. Although I like that exchange.
She catches the next sandworm.
Yeah. But see, the big thing there is what she wanted and what he said he wanted was, he said, I would love to be equals with you. And that's what she wanted.
Yeah. Okay.
She wanted this equality. She wanted this, egalitarian structure with a fellow Fremen warrior.
Yeah.
That she thought was cute.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Speaking, so two directions to go with that. Paul being, you know, the Timothée Chalamet being the character he
Timothée Chalamet.
Denis Villeneuve.
Yes. Dune.
As far Part as
Du.
the French version. as far as that's concerned, do you saying it needs more dilemmas? As I've heard it also being, you know, attacked for being too straightforward.
Yeah, like, moments of choice. Yeah. There need to be clear moments of choice. So there's this whole pressure that's going on of, is he the one? Is he not the one? Mm. Is he the one? Is he not the one? He makes his big choice when he goes and drinks the poison.
Yeah.
And it's sort of not, well, it's just not set up that way. It doesn't have like a breaker switch of a choice, like a, you know, it's like we kind of ease into it.
Yeah.
That'd and be then much better.
When he speaks to the whole room full, that's where you really see him own, like that huge room of Fremen. Yeah. That's where you see him own the one yep. and, you know, change yep. the rules instead and of the killing
the feminists were all mad, and there's quite a few of them are mad because he abandons this egalitarian Disney love with his first girlfriend mm-hmm. to pursue his true destiny. He ignores his mom and rolls hard in that scene yeah. with the Fremen. And she's like, slow down. And he's just like,
let's go.
And he's like, throttle up. And he goes harder.
Yeah.
And then he even like, you know, just voice of power smacks in a very moment, a great moment of catharsis. The Reverend Mother.
Oh, so good.
Just yeah. like, oh, shut up, woman. We're sick of you. And we've never
seen blasphemy.
Yeah. It's like, you know, like,
yeah.
So it's those things like he crushes.
Yeah.
In different ways and to different degrees, crushes and or just abandons and overrules all the women in his life as he goes in his messianic direction. And that has not gone unnoticed in the age of Barbie.
But his mom won. She got him.
Kind of.
She got him exactly where she wanted him, kept him alive.
Kind of.
Set up the baby sister.
So, I mean, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Too. But yeah, his mom wins.
Right.
But his mom wins because she loves him and she wants him to, you know, to do this.
Yeah.
She also doesn't win because she's taken on like centuries of suffering of this people that she doesn't care about.
Well, yeah, she lost her identity. He's yeah. searching for his and she completely lost hers.
Yeah, she gets
and just, so it is interesting to watch that.
Yeah. So she makes this massive sacrifice for the sake of her son and what she believes to be his destiny, even though her sect is yeah. not on that side and has no sides and is supposed to be remaining neutral. So she wins, but she doesn't get to steer him the way that she thinks she's going to steer him. The outcome is what she wants. And it's a little bit, I mean, this is, it's a long way away from this, but this is a little bit of the wedding in Cana. Where,
okay, whoa,
where,
transition.
Where you see him just saying like, gune, like woman.
Yeah.
It's not my time. And then he still does it. And there's this dynamic of mom believer, mm-hmm. like the mom believer who's there way before anybody else, and the son who's going to time things his way. Mm. And even when she gets her way, like in a moment, which she does in that situation,
yeah.
Even when she gets her way, it's still not going, you know, in the way and at the pace that she gets to choose. You know, it's like she's not getting to drive. So he gives it to her at the wedding. Okay. But she doesn't get to drive anything else, even though her belief is intact
yeah.
really early in the story. And so you see something similar dynamic here where she thinks that she has the pacing down. She thinks she understands it all. And she makes this big, you know, act of sacrifice to help fulfill the prophecy.
Right.
And is right, but doesn't get to drive.
Right, right.
You know, she's not driving in a way that she did drive his whole life. And that moment's gone. And it's gone ahead of schedule for her. But even there, those are all examples of little character, like horns and dilemmas that I think could have been called out and heightened. So Zendaya's character needs it.
Yeah.
Paul's character needs it.
Yeah. Paul's so willowy and she's a little bit masculine. I don't know the way, like, clearly the egalitarian way that they seem to both be.
Yeah.
I guess is intentional.
Yep.
I thought Paul seemed like he pulled it off pretty well. I was wondering yeah. if they were messing with his voice throughout, but I don't know. I haven't seen enough of Chalamet to know yeah. what they were doing, but
he's pretty good actually.
He seemed like he nailed it.
Don't look up. He's got the best role ever.
Yeah. He's a good one there.
So he's got range.
He's another, well, that's Messiah too. So I don't know. He's kind of messianic. So I don't know if he does anything but Messiah.
Yeah. So Dune 2 was enjoyable to me, and yet it was grandiose in its curvature, like really slow turns.
Yeah.
And I think that some of those things needed peaks. So you could get there. It felt like flavor.
Like you're just tasting the same
flavor and rhythm.
And for a long time.
It needed some breaks where you're rising and it's undulating and it is in fact the same rhythm. I think the rhythm was effective, but there have to be these punctuated moments of turn. There's a couple of them, but there's a number of character turns where it should be a clear, like this way or that way, throw the breaker, make your choice.
Yeah.
He makes his choice. Then she has to make her choice and he's betting on her to make the right choice. And she's not going to be able to forgive him for it.
Because he's being manipulating. Yeah.
And she's mad.
Yeah.
She's mad. And he's like, also, I'm going to marry somebody else.
Yeah.
Now that you brought me back, I'm going to do that too.
Right.
And this is proving to not be at all an egalitarian relationship.
Right.
Well, for good and ill.
A couple of things that fascinated me that I didn't think were going to. That opening scene where those guys go up to the top of the cliff, you know, and then get shot. I don't know how he made that so compelling, but that opening image of just them all hiding on the dune and then some space. I thought Star Wars had ruined me for new space things, you know? Just like, I've seen this a billion times, but something about it was...
Well, it's not space.
Sure.
I mean, that's
not space. There you go.
It's not space. Austin Butler did a great job too, although...
Who's he?
I was surprised.
Which is he? Fade.
Why am I forgetting his name?
The friend?
No, the dude, the bald.
Oh, Fade Rotha.
Fade. I was like, Raid? What is no. Yeah. Fade.
Fade Rotha.
So yeah,
awesome. He was a scary one.
I was surprised they put as much time into him to just have him die quite like that. I thought that could have had a bigger payoff.
The fight felt very
Yeah, they needed a bigger payoff given how much they'd invested in him as a character.
Same thing with the Baron's death.
Yeah.
You know, but that,
he dies like an animal is that was.
Yeah. Okay. Him getting de-ballooned and falling on the stairs was perhaps one of the most satisfying payoffs. And then Paul killing him so fast, but then also killing Fade Rotha so fast.
Yeah. I would have liked the Fade fight to have gone differently.
Yeah. I was wondering
In terms of the rhythm, the musical rhythm of that particular conflict, I think, could have been handled differently.
Right, because, in the book, he tries to use a poison spike on his belt, like a cheating, functionally, like a very Fade Rotha move. In this one, it felt very much more just equals and who can accept the most pain, which is kind of Fade's whole thing, is he's great at accepting pain.
Yeah.
And Paul manages to outpain him.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, that's if we're really stretching.
Yeah.
It just is sort of like, it's hard, it's close, but Paul wins.
Yeah.
It doesn't get really much more complicated than that. And it needed to.
And I was still struggling with Christopher Walken being slightly too famous for his role, I thought, in the Emperor.
I thought he did pretty good.
I just kept expecting things that.
He's going to do his, some weird.
Yeah, some shimmy. Pattern. Some slight shimmy.
Yeah, that's possible.
But I realized that was my fault, not necessarily Christopher Walken's fault.
That's
And funny. Then the worms. When he first jumped on the worm, that actually. I don't know if you felt like it had payoff, but I thought it paid off pretty well.
Yeah, it did.
And I was also not expecting
that. You have to really
that.
Invest a lot of suspension of your disbelief.
Yeah, how do they get on moment. And off the worms?
Yeah.
I didn't know how they got the woman in the basket.
It's grappling hooks. Oh.
We're pulling the worms' noses up with grappling hooks so they don't want the sand to get in. And then...
They stay up.
They stay up. And then same thing with her, the pregnant lady in the basket on the back of the worm.
I like that.
How do they get the pregnant lady off the basket?
They jump.
Obviously. They roll her off?
They throw her. I don't know. They've got lots of gadgets there in Fremen land, which they apparently designed in their factories, which don't exist anywhere.
I made a mistake of reading up on some of his inspiration for it. You know, Lawrence of Arabia, peyote mushrooms. Lots of other stuff that just made me wish I hadn't read up on it because his work is so much better than his inspirations.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That I now shared them with you all. So there we go.
So that's Dune 2. What else? What was part of our movie mop up? We're going to do.
You got to tell me about.
I can say Cabrini.
Cabrini. Yeah.
I have not watched the cut that was released. And I was mostly just kind of like, eh. I mentioned on this podcast, I really liked the original trailer. I enjoyed the extended cut and thought it would be improved by reduction. But then Angel went all in on this International Women's Day release.
Oh, no. And I was
why though? Like,
that's what I was worried about.
You're not going to get the people you think you're going to get with this. And the people that want to support this film, like, it's almost like a deterrent. Like, yeah. Wait, they're just going to be already like,
okay, I'm going to watch a movie about the first Jesuit woman missionary or whatever, which is already, you know, a first.
Yeah.
And then for you to lean in as if it's a global.
This is International Women's Day. You're like, okay. So, I mean, she was cool. She was great. She had to battle actual sexism. She had to be tough as nails,
right?
You know, and get this done in New York.
And did great things. So yeah, all the ingredients
did great things, and it was beautifully shot. So
the ingredients for a great story are there.
The rollout, especially because I liked the first trailer so much. So I've commented on the first trailer a lot. But I have not seen the cut. I've not seen the reduced cut. So I don't know how I feel about the finished film. But I am curious to see it. I'm looking forward to it. I know it's going to be worth seeing. I'm just curious how much of the rollout, the marketing rollout is reflective of some of the edits made. I don't know. I don't know if it became more International Women's Day in its reduction or if that is just imposed on the release.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the danger would be that it becomes much more cardboard than it was, I guess. Yeah. Just much more of her line about,
but still but beautifully shot and worth and worth seeing.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then Boys in a Boat too. I'm just gonna pick your
brain. Watch it?
I haven't watched it
you
yet.
Okay, you should watch it. Have you read the book?
Nope.
Okay.
Well, let's just say my child.
let's say that for everybody, the book is mandatory.
Okay.
The book's really good, and the movie is kind of striking. I told my wife, told my kids that it's kind of like having a really, you know, you eat a hamburger. You're like, yeah, it's fine. It's not, that was pretty good burger. And then you look over on the counter and see that they'd cut the tip off of this amazing tri-tip and ground it up and made a patty. And, you know, thrown some American cheese on it and done this little like.
So the source material on this thing is great.
Yeah. And then you're just disappointed. You're like, why did I just eat this as a hamburger with like mediocre cheese and Thousand Island dressing?
Yeah.
You know, and it was fine. It was a little picnic burger and it's pretty good. You know, and your Uncle Ralph's like, how'd you like the burger? And you're like, yeah, it was good. And you're not lying.
Yeah, it's a park.
Yeah.
It's a park burger.
Yeah. And then you go look at, it was like, wait, this was Wagyu, gold label, tri-tip. Like, why did we do this? The source material is some of the best source material of all time in terms of potential for a story. It could have competed as the best sports movie of all time with that source material. And instead, it just catastrophically came up short of that. Mm-hmm. So it's devoid of suffering. It basically adapted away from every single strength of the book.
Now I'm really curious, but maybe we do need to read it.
You do. Yeah, you do. You should read it and watch it. You should do.
Fascinating.
And this is one I would say for anybody who's not read the book, go ahead and watch the movie first. Eat the picnic burger. He's like, yeah, it's fun. It's, you know, because our bar is really low as dads when we have kids. And you're like, hey, here's a clean sports movie we could watch about some guys who worked hard and won. Yeah, they worked hard and they won, but then go read the book or listen to the audiobook. And it's really shocking to go that direction. And so one of the things they miss is this toxic, poisonous, internal competitiveness in the Washington program. And there are these different boys in different boats who hate each other and competing with each other, and they're vying for the varsity boat, and they're, you know, falling in and out, and they're getting moved. And then three of them discover mutually that they're actually poor because they all show up at the Grand Coulee Dam to work all summer in the works projects. And these three are guys dangling on cliffs with 75-pound jackhammers. Like, they're rappelling down cliff faces, running 75-pound jackhammers on cliff faces for 8 hours a day all summer. And these three guys were from rival boats inside that toxic program. And through this, like, death-defying, terrifying experience, they came together. Those three came together. And those three got put into the lead boat together afterwards and became this unbeatable boat. And they're the Western rural poor versus this Eastern hoity-toity.
Yeah, boat rowing, mostly, you know, what thing. We think of. Yeah.
These guys were so backward that, you know, they're out there on the Hudson. They heard FDR's house was somewhere on the Hudson. So they went and found it and walked up and knocked on the door. And his son let him in. They're like, hey, was the president here? And we wanted to say hi. You know, it's like, it's.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're those kind of guys. When they went to the Olympic trials, which incidentally are just skipped in the story, in the film. But when they go to the Olympic trials, it's hot and it's humid. And so they decide to go skins.
Awesome.
And they're at this Princeton. Okay, yeah. It's this Princeton country club.
Yeah.
And they go skins. They win. And when they get off, the chairman of the Olympic committee comes over and is giving a speech for all the news cameras and is giving them this trophy. And they're going to go to Berlin. And the guy is just talking for too long. And so the coxswain just yanks the trophy out of his hand and they just all walk off on camera while the guy's giving him the presentation speech. It's like, these guys are poachers. Like, they survived by poaching. These are loggers. These are some hard Western kids, and they're from here, you know.
Yeah, PNW rednecks, yeah. Sort
of.
Yeah,
yeah. No, it's our very unique breed of what we're familiar with, and kind of the tough, tough, tough as nails, rural poor out here, who then did that, and achieved that, and hated each other and competed with each other until they got shoved into this brutal manual labor situation.
And that's all what's missing. That's none all of that's missing there. From the movie.
None of it's there. Artificially, like the thing I was talking about in Dune, where they need these horns of these dilemmas, they need these moments of choice. They try to create those and impose those, but they have to manufacture them. There's so much real conflict and there's so much real suffering in the real story that they just omit. And so they then have to conjure up new ones. And so right beforehand, you know, Joe's gonna quit. That dude was never gonna quit anything in his life. It's like, he's going to walk off. It's never mind. He's not going to walk off. And
right.
And on top of that, I think that one season was the rainiest season in history in Seattle that they were training it still. Like, just is still the most just torrential, frigid. A friend whose comment walking out of the theater was like, well, you knew that was fake because being from Seattle, you know, it's like living in Seattle, it didn't rain once in that whole movie. You know, it's like the misery and the suffering, it's all kind of this hallmark glow is just kind of nostalgia. It's just placed over it. And the very specific, miserable ice dangling on your oars level of suffering is mostly absent. It's not all absent, but it's mostly absent. Yeah. But the movie itself is kind of like, hey, you know, it's something fun and clean to show your kids. And these guys worked hard and they won. And it's a great little burger. You know, it's a good little picnic burger. Uncle Ralph, thumbs up. And then you go read the book and you're like, wait a second.
What did Ralph do?
This is incredible. This could have been the best ever. This could have been amazing. This could have been a whole season. This could have been a series that would have been.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. And instead, it was just that Thousand Island American cheeseburger.
Yeah.
So that was Boys in the Boat.
Wow. That's good.
And then Masters of the Air, say filter it. Not great arc-wise, but very interesting historically. Just I really enjoyed watching through it for that reason.
Yeah.
What else do we need to hit? We had Cambrini, Boys in the Boat, Dune 2.
I mean, I think that was the big four. That
we wanted to get through these things. All this, like, we procrastinated. I went on vacation. We stopped talking for a while.
Here we are. We did them. We'll catch up on the other ones. We got
through. I feel like there was something else.
We got to do another lamp.
Yeah, we have to.
We were supposed to talk about, prison escape movie.
Shawshank. Yeah.
But
great film.
We can't squeeze that. We can't squeeze that on the end.
Let's go ahead and say that Dune 2 is past Shawshank. I don't know if it's still. It did pass Shawshank as the highest rated film of all time on IMDb.
Dune 2 did or Dune?
Dune 2.
Whoa.
Past Shawshank. Now, did it stay ahead? I don't know. But I saw the headline pop.
Well, that's kind of crazy, right?
Yeah, it is. I don't know if it's merited. Shawshank is...
I don't think that seems merited at all, but I very much enjoyed, you know. And oh, cool part about Dune 2 is just watching Villeneuve, write, direct, produce.
Villeneuve met Timothée.
Yeah. Watching him write, direct, produce something that he's loved since he was a boy. That's cool. Yeah. And I think you could feel that.
Oh, yeah. No, you feel that, the affection.
That right there is what saved it and what has ruined things like
Lord of the Rings. He was not a, well, I would say.
Let's not open that can of tiger worms right at the end.
He just threw a tire off a bridge into the pond. I'll say that he's obviously not a hireling. He obviously has deep affection.
Yeah.
But he also has some taste.
Yeah.
And in production design and his delegation, the people he's delegated to in different roles have been fantastic. I really would like to see other edits. I would like to see particular threads edited differently, but I thought his commitment to the whole is pretty clear. I think Jackson's commitment to Lord of the Rings as like a boy who loved it and grew up loving it is not a thing that is, as much as I'll insult him, is not a thing that I would actually pick on. I'm sure he really, really, I'm sure he really loved the source material. I'm sure it really affected him. It's the taste.
Sure.
It's okay. The taste and his incomprehension of story architecture and what made the originals work
that bothers me.
Whereas this feels more submissive to the source material.
Yeah, it did.
Than Jackson was.
Right.
He was
Again, Dune story, fun that it was serialized.
Yeah.
And then failed for 20 publishers, finally picked up by a car publishing. They published auto manuals mostly, and it failed for them, and the editor who acquired it was fired. And then eventually over time, it's become this great thing, but started out as a real lame duck.
It's kind of funny.
It is really funny.
It's really weird that's the story. It's strange when you take things like this and people are going to fall in love with the world and psychos are going to fall in love with the world. They're going to go all in.
Cult classic.
Yeah, in ways that they shouldn't. But it is a really striking and interesting world. And it's rare that you find innovative, like really innovative worlds that feel real and whole, they feel intact.
Yeah.
And it has that sensation of being intact. Like there is a dark side to this moon. You know that if you go around that moon, you're going to see everything that's over there. That's never going to show up in the story, but it's all here. Everything's been built.
Right.
And you feel that commitment in the films.
Yeah. As if you ask a question, there will be an answer, even though.
Yeah.
Felt that about almost all of it.
Yeah, very much so. So I enjoyed it. I'll probably watch it again in theaters at least once. Well, no more than one more time. Then we'll see. There's still a few things I want to hunt down, but we'll talk about Shawshank next time.
Great.
And whatever else we're covering.
There we go.
But there was something else. Scrolling through. I checked out a little of Guy Ritchie's new show. It's like, this kind of amoral and blah.
Yeah.
I know what I was going to say. Shogun.
Oh, yeah. We were talking
Shogun
about that briefly.
And Dune are both examples of right now, if people push out content that is male-centric and really aggressively goes after committed worlds and reality in terms of not politicizing, not coming in and imposing current trends and sensibilities on the story. And so Shogun is not trying to be contemporary or PC at all. It's just trying to tell you the story of Japan as it was then.
Right.
And what it was like.
A very much foreign world.
Yeah. Like and alien. For this British guy who washes in. And then Dune's doing the same thing. He's, even though it's fantastical, even though it's fantasy, he's refusing to accommodate that world to contemporary sensibilities. And in both those cases, it's blowing up. Shogun is on Hulu, which is a little nothing, you know, just a nothing platform, and compared to the giants. And it's crushing in terms of streaming counts. It's crushing Netflix. You know, it's actually, it's at the top. And that's really striking. And so when people are trying to feminize or create sensitivities or impose any kind of, it doesn't have to be feminization, but just impose any of our sensitivities, any of our scruples right now, any of our very, very trendy manners, like any of those that get imposed into the story, get imposed into the content, is like the kiss of death right now. People want to see worlds that are existing entirely outside of all the pressures and all the wokeness and all the, all the little, you know, viral manners that we have now about how you have to say this, that, the other thing.
Yeah. People want to feel the fervor.
Yeah. And so, but it's like, there's an especially deep driven desire in the male audience to experience true escapism from this toxic moment. They want to get out of this moment that kind of, you know, is unkind to them in some ways, and just watch something wholly other, experience something wholly other with no memories and no references and no allusions to the way it actually is in their time right now. They want that full transformative escapism into a masculine ethic and into a masculine story. Both Dune and Shogun are that way. And the male viewer is watching so little right now that they've been dumping games on platforms. They're trying to re-engage the male audience.
Is that why Netflix dropped video games? To try to get guys playing those old arcade games on it?
And they're so, but just the men are leaving the streamers, and it's, which is wild. Like, they're just leaving and they're trying to get the male audience back. And it's two big examples of how it's done right now are Shogun and Dune. Shogun, I don't know if it has filters. If it does, it'd be Clear Play, because it's owned FX, on Hulu, owned by Disney. Disney has some series that are filtered via Clear Play. VidAngel has none, nothing through Disney. So it might end up with filters. It needs a couple, you know, but it's pretty skippable too. So if you're watching it as an adult, the scenes are,
you can blitz
it's,
through.
Yeah. It's like, oh, that's pretty easy. And here we go. Skip, skip. Yeah. But it's really striking how successful both of these things have been via radical escapism away from all the toxic change that's happened in our own society.
Also the swords. They both have lots of swords.
They both have some swords. Does Dune have a bunch of swords?
The knives, yeah. The Chris
they
got knife. Some,
I mean,
the
they Chris both, knife. Let's say they both have pointy objects.
I just
but
think
I don't
key.
Think those are, I,
wanna,
I don't know that those are
I want to watch something with swords.
Okay, fine. They both have swords, Brian. Yeah. Well, there you go. So it's funny to see very expensive, large productions targeting male viewers almost exclusively, targeting male viewers that then also capture the whole.
Yeah. Cause your wife, audience. Your wife will come watch it with you. I can attest.
She'll come take a nap.
Yeah.
My wife slept really well.
My wife woke up and said, wait, how did they get inside at the end? And I thought, oh no, you missed
it. I'm trying to remember what my wife hit me and asked a question. She hit me and asked something. And I was like, I can't explain that. That's
this just matters so much.
It was like the previous 2 hours.
No, this was just short from Christy.
Yeah. She, our problem is our local theater has really comfortable seats.
Yeah. They,
so just like
kick the feet up boop,
and you're out. Okay. That's enough. Enough movie talk for one day.
Wow. We almost hit an hour today. That'll make up for having missed a week.
Yeah. Let's just pat ourselves on the back and say that we missed a week and it doesn't matter because we went for an hour.
Yep.
Cheers.
The end.
Hey, Christian Dad, are you paying a monthly fee to let Hollywood producers pump their septic tanks directly into your living room? Even worse, directly into your imagination and the imaginations of your children. How much darkness streams into your home every day, every week? Have you gotten too used to turning your mind off when you put your feet up? Have you invited your own enemies into your home? How much damage has already been done to you and to your family?
My heart says that the way I feel most myself is to go by the name Fred. That's because I'm non-binary.
Canon Plus is building a global platform with one simple goal: to create and deliver great content that will help Christian families grow stronger and more dangerous in the world. Content that will kick your brain's butt and help you bear down and step up. Content that will encourage, equip, educate, challenge, and inspire your family. Content built on the bedrock of real truth, real goodness, not fake trendy virtues.
How dare you!
And real, lasting beauty. Your family might already be struggling. Maybe the man of the house has been sipping too much Bud Light Gospel in the basement for too long.
It's day 6 of girlhood!
But it's not too late. With thousands of audiobooks, podcasts, truth-telling documentaries, and curriculum for all ages, Canon Plus wants to help you grow stronger together with your family. There might be enemies at the gates, but there's a feast on the table to strengthen you for the fight. We want the resources we produce to help you do the real work of cultural change, becoming a lighthouse in your own community, armed with courageous joy and a faith that burns hot and bright, especially when the world would rather keep you on a cute little dimmer switch. We don't have to wallow in the world's filth.
Moonlight, best picture.
You are gay.
We don't need to let our strength atrophy like numbed victims of some ungodly matrix, leaving our families unprotected and vulnerable. It's time for Christian fathers to stop being such cultural cuckolds, well-behaved Wonderbread winners sitting by and paying for the world to assault their families with lies. Let's get strong and grow our families strong. Let's raise our kids to be the world's worst nightmares. Smart, secure, fearless, joyful, difficult to control, and quick to laugh at lies and nonsense. We're pushing back against the rising tide of sewage on our screens. We're pumping out antidotes to the world's poisons. But we can't do it alone. We need allies. You need allies. So consider this your invitation to join up and make things a little awkward for all our weaker brethren in church leadership.
It's not that we're against anything.
Who so badly want to be worldly cool kids. Help us build a streaming platform unlike any other. A platform that will challenge and strengthen Christians, mind, body, and soul, until this cultural tide begins to turn.
She's dreaming about becoming the leader she knows she can be.
And yes, this tide will turn. This ain't the Alamo. We're all gonna die, but we have no intention of losing. Canon Plus. You don't have to subscribe. But you do have to stop sucking.